Sid, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve. I caught the last 30 minutes of that. That was really good.
Well, and you were referenced by Tim. Tim provided a Sid Fernando reference.
Really? It must have been in the part before I
he
watched.
Did.
But he did quote me in his article, though.
Yeah, that's what he was. Yeah, that's what he was circling back to. And okay,
yeah, we had a great conversation when he called me. You know, I could only use some of what I said, but what did he reference me about?
The same thing that he quoted you on. I mean, the complexity here that I think we only, you know, you could, I could spend the 15 hours a week doing nothing but, you know, deeper analysis of this. The industry, the complexities, just the complexities within the breeding and bloodstock side of the business are so extensive. There are so many portions of this business that I don't want to even say are at cross purposes, even though there is plenty of that. But there's so many different kinds of interests that are represented from the start of a horse's career to the end of their life. And within that cycle, I mean, I don't think there's anything comparable, Sid. I mean, is there anything you can think of that has more different components involved?
Yeah, it is complex. And the conversation you guys had was, you know, absolutely first class. It was one of the best. Your comments, your opinions on it, and what he said, it encompassed quite a bit. And Tim's real sensitive to it. But, you know, one of the things that, and I, you know, I even said, it was part of a long statement, but he just used part one quote where it made me sound perhaps like my wife read it and said, oh my God, you sound really hard at compared, you know, I said I viewed horses as livestock, kind of what you were talking about, in a reference to that, whereas, you know, Tim just now said that it's not just special interest groups, it's part of society at large, which it is, which I also mentioned as well. It's very complex, it's one part of this bigger issue of animal, not just safety, but animal welfare that's only touched upon in the game because, you know, guys like Tim writing about this, guys like Joe Drake constantly discussing breakdowns. And these animal special interest group, animal welfare groups like PETA and so forth, speaking about just the sport. And, you know, if you're honest about this, the reality is it gets back to actually what you were talking about growing up with 4-H kids and that they realize, you know, they treat these animals with great care, but they realize what their fate's going to be. Well, if you want to be really honest about it, it's an extension of that in racing because what nobody talks about is that eventually, for a lot of these horses, you know, they disappear, and where do they go? Well, you know, it's pretty obvious what happens to them, but nobody touches that part of it.
So, that's fair. You do see that comment, you know, you can't save everyone and, you know, you'd be amazed at how hard it is actually to keep track, and, you know, monitor where, you know, where everyone goes. I mean, we've been involved with maybe how many horses, probably 35 horses, I suppose, and I know where the majority ended up, but I can't. I there's a couple that I really am not certain where they are, and you know, you try to follow. I suppose this is a yet another conversation about the microchip option, and you know, we've dragged our feet as an industry, and not just us, but you know, all equine sport. You know, why are we not microchipping these horses so that we can, you know, geo track, you know, virtually anyone? And, you know, this is, you know, maybe one thing that delayed that was some people don't want to know where they are and where they end up. I mean, that, you know, I think we've done a very good job. I mean, this all gets back to Acceler. I mean, and, you know, the, and Ferdinand. I mean, this was a revelation to a lot of people, even within the industry. So it kind of woke people up. And ever since then, there's been this pronounced and very successful effort to, you know, create second careers, or at least create safe havens.
Yeah.
I mean, we've made huge progress, tremendous progress in this area. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's been a huge progress from within the industry too, and that's really been heartening. But you know, again, that's not part of the specific part of what I was bringing up. But the reality is that you got 20,000 foals every year. They keep running, and imagine when there was 50,000 foals every year. Okay. What do people really think was happening to those foals? It's a huge number of foals, you know, and if people are so concerned about, you know, hundreds or a thousand, whatever the number is that they break down per year on a track, we're talking here tens of thousands, you know, and that's why to be in this game, for me personally, it boils down to, I'm an animal lover. I love animals. And, you know, when I was young, I was really traumatized because I came across a young dog that somebody had tied to a fence and beaten up. And it just really, really traumatized me. And I tried to, as a kid, you try to go through, you know, you want to help animals, and And as I grew up, I realized I can't control every single thing. And as a self-protective mechanism, I just went into, well, I can only control the animals within my life, or, you know, help.
Yeah, sphere of influence.
Right, exactly. But I can't do the entire thing. And, you know, that's just a personal a moment of trying to, from one guy trying to figure out, how do you exist in that thing? And I think what you referenced was really important for people to hear. That 4-H story really resonated with me, because Tim talked about these grooms and how they love these. Of course they do, but so do those kids that you're talking about. They're brought up to respect the animal, and they show off these, they care for them, but they know where their fate is eventually headed. And that's a mindset that at some point you got to have a reckoning with the people in this industry too. Once they get beyond trying to put out this brush fire of breakups, there's a bigger issue for everybody to address and reconcile for themselves.
Well, exactly. That part of it, you know, is central to the discussion, mm-hmm. And I find it strange. I mean, we've arrived at some point in these discussions, or in society at large, where certain people, you know, seem you know, hell bent on imposing their I don't know if it's not even will so much as it is their sensibility on others. And
yeah,
you know, I that certainly is something that, you know, that certainly is something when opinion and sensibilities coalesce on a widespread basis. Yeah, that'll affect change. But the critique here is, to me, is overly. Is overly acute and critical, knowing how much progress we've made as an industry, and people can scoff at that all they want, but it's only even in the last 10 to 15 years that we started to even count how many horses were being injured.
That's true. I mentioned that maybe. In Finn's article, when he asked me, I said, you know, in the 70s, because I was a kid following racing in the 70s, it happened. It was, you know, again, it's a change that we've had gradually as a society, but these breakdowns didn't just suddenly happen in the last 10 to 15 years.
No.
That's what people have to understand. It's always occurred, but there's now... the societal changes where people are acutely aware that, you know, an animal death is a bit, you know, naturally. And so, and great changes have occurred because of that sensitivity to it. And your part where you mentioned it about the breeding aspect of it in terms of dirt racing. You know, dirt racing is obviously the big component of our racing here, and breeders kind of reacted against the forced mandated synthetics in California, and then later the voluntary synthetic revolution that took place. Revolted against that because what their feeling was that the nature of the American racehorse was changing. And that nature basically was that American racehorses have become wanted and valued the world over because of the rigorous testing that they've had over dirt. It's very unforgiving surface, and so those that the American Pharaohs, the whatever, the great secretariats, these horses, they triumph over some of the toughest ground, and they're known for that great combination of speed and stamina, toughness, which has made the American racehorse the most desirable racehorse for other countries. I mean, if you take Japan, where everybody's talking about how great the racing is in Japan, look at the Yoshida brothers buying mares at the sale, right? They Zenya Yoshida, their father, purchased and sent over the Derby winner Sunday Silence there, who revolutionized the entire breeding industry there. He was a dirt horse. Of course, their best racing in Japan is on turf. They do race 50-50 dirt and turf in Japan, but 80%, 90% of their graded races are on turf in Japan. That's the main element. That's where Sunday Silence triumphed. If you talk about Europe, and we've talked about this before, Gilmore's MV Magna talked about how his... grandfather, who was Vincent O'Brien, made his name on the quote-unquote on the backs of the American dirt horses, end quote. Well, you know, it was that Northern Dancer revolution that took everything to another level. Northern Dancer, a Derby winner, of course, his progeny starting with Nijinsky, the last British Triple Crown winner, completely revolutionized the game in Europe, so much so that the Northern Dancer Stallion Sadler as well is the sire, the iconic sire, the sire of Galileo, who's the greatest sire, one of the greatest sires in the world and the greatest sire in Europe. So, you know, it's a dirt testing here that is what the breeders wanted. So when they rejected the synthetics, it was because they felt that their horses weren't getting the proper testing that needed to happen. And, you know, I said it somewhere, I can't remember where, maybe it was on Twitter, but if you're gonna go that route, then have the nuts to stand up and say, look, we're going to lose some horses, we're going to break horses down, but it's our goal is dirt racing, and we want to have this product that we can only develop over dirt surface, and unfortunately, it's going to create this. Otherwise, say, we want safety, and we're going to do only synthetic surfaces to stem the tide of breakdowns. But instead of going one way or the other, these guys in this business straddle the fence. They don't say anything. And so they're constantly pummeled on every side. There's no voice that they can, there's no one single voice to begin with, but there's no method that they have to articulate this exact thing that I just told you, which is the truth.
Which, had no idea we were going, you know, we'd end up in this direction. But when Keeneland invested in the Polytrack company and foisted the first edition, the rather unprepared first edition of synthetics on the industry, you know, which is largely responsible for the poor taste in everybody's mouth. I mean, the promises that were made that ended up being completely hollow about how it was maintenance free and it was ambient condition, you know, pure, that nothing was going to affect it. I mean, all of these pie in the sky promises that none of which really panned out. It created this atmosphere where the from the better to the track management to, you know, virtually every part of the equation were completely disgusted by the experience, and that has given the impression that, you know, that synthetics aren't the answer when they very well may be. But I'm curious, do you recall, Sid, because you would have been, you know, right on the, you know, right on the pulse of this, did Keeneland management consult with the breeding community when they made the transition and introduced the Polytrack the first time?
I think they did, but you know what, Steve? I don't think anybody realized in those early days what was going to happen. So in other words, nobody in their wildest dreams would ever imagine that scenario would favor turf type of horses, okay? So what ended up happening, because these were early days, was suddenly, guess what happened? For the first time in history, a horse that whose progeny essentially just ran on turf or all weather became the leading sire in the United States, general sire. That was Kitten's Joy. That was a huge revelation, okay? Because this is a dirt country, and the thinking at that time, nobody really, you know, there was an inkling that it was going to favor some turf horses, but they didn't understand the full ramifications of it. Of course, these were also early days, as you pointed out, of these synthetic tracks that are much more sophisticated now. The tracks, for example, in England that Dickinson has overseen, Wolverhampton and so forth, those tracks have really incredible safety records. If you're talking, I think I've seen figures of like zero, you know, like here it's like, you know, 1.65 per thousand is considered good. I've seen figures there of 0.23. But anyway, getting back to this question, once it became evident, and forget about the conditions of the track and everything, once it became evident, Steve, that this was starting to favor turf horses, that's when you had the reaction against it. At Keeneland, of course, don't forget, they are built around, all the big guys in there are, you know, part of the big the Kentucky breeding industry. So, yes, they did have that backing. It was the reaction to the results that resulted in the repeal of that surface. And so that became, you know, that was when, and it's super ironic, actually, because as that became repealed, there was a concurrent movement in this country for more turf racing. So, ironically, venues such as Saratoga, which is more than 50% of all races at Saratoga now are on turf. You can take the entire meet, take every race there, and go race by race, whether it's a stakes race or a maiden, whatever it is, and you just take the number of races and look at which are on turf or dirt, simple math, simple arithmetic, 50% of the races are on turf. So it's quite amazing that as the synthetics were repealed, the highest levels of racing in this country were getting more turf oriented.
Obvious.
And the same thing holds true for Del Mar too. By the way, it's like 40% of the races at Del Mar on turf.
Very
so
much.
The biggest money, the biggest money is still available for turf horses.
And if we want to fold in, you know, fold in the horseplay side, it's not that it's quote unquote preferable, but it's certainly you know, an area that the horse playing community just loves. I mean, we get bigger fields, we get you know, a lot of trip action, and you know, very very marketable from that standpoint. I mean,
and that's probably the instigator for the track. The fact that you're getting fuller fields, more, you know, that led to that explosion in turf. But however, even prior to that, Steve, if you just take the one subset of graded stakes races, it's been close to 38-40% of all graded stakes races, independently of the explosion of turf racing, were already on turf.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
we were in that direction. We've been moving in that direction, you know, for inexorably, really. I mean, it
right, yeah.
Well, we potential to make it even more prevalent. This is not anything we're going to decide on immediately, but if the cause, as Tim laid out, said continues to be championed and that drum is beaten, you know, more steadily, there's absolutely going to be a move and a need to incorporate synthetic, because it'll tell a story that the industry, you know, would be proud to champion at that point.
I think that, you know, it's kind of, I was talking to Wesley Ward the other day, and he, you know, he was telling me about, in his opinion, Turfway has the safest surface. He said you can just, you know, you can do anything on that thing with a horse, and they're not going to get hurt. Which ironically was the complaint that I heard from this one breeder, owner breeder, whose name I'm not going to say, but his big thing against synthetics once they were, you know, running fairly reliably, was that he was just mad as heck that a horse with leg problems that wouldn't survive racing on dirt could win big races on synthetics. And then go into the breeding pool and breed. And if that horse had been tested on dirt, there's no way he would have ever survived the rigors of it. And so he was complaining about that same safety mechanism on the inverse end, that a horse with issues has more life on synthetics, but he takes those problems into the breeding shed because of the success he's had on the surface. And essentially what they like to take into the breeding shed are those horses that, you know, survive the pounding. And even if they didn't survive it, even horses with abbreviated careers showed enough brilliance on it to go into that shed. So it's really an interesting discussion when you parse it from various filters, you know?
Well, and all of that, it goes very simply to confirmation and to the physical makeup of the horses in question. And
right.
You know, the two different physical equations involved in horses turning over when their hooves slide on dirt versus sticking on synthetic or on turf. And
right.
it's that simple. I mean, it all has to do with their action and the way that they're conformed, pure and simple. And I mean, if it's going to long term be a scenario where, yeah, the breeding is going to have to ultimately, you know, go in the direction of the turf preferred type physically, then the industry will, you know, the industry will conform. The market demands will dictate, and we'll see. You do get the sense, and it apparently is a conversation that. It's funny, you know, you've pointed this out, Sid, that you know, the Jockey Club in particular, they seem to only want to have one part of the safety and welfare discussion. Right? They've conveniently ignored this one because there isn't a ready answer to it. And you know, they have not. I mean, if the concerns were widespread and complete, the initiatives would include an exhortation to the industry to move toward the synthetics and the synthetic and turf, which, you know, are just have lower incidence of calamity.
And that exact thing was something I addressed in a column during the Santa Anita issue, kind of actually brought up the Jockey Club in it, because if you recall, during the period of breakdowns was exact, and during the highest level of insanity, when people were screeching at each other, it was during that period when the Jockey Club's lobbyists and people introduced the latest version of the Integrity Act in the House. And so, you know, the crux of that thing is, aside from all the other things in it, is the Lasix issue. So I pointed out that they introduced this thing, and if they're really concerned about welfare, well, why didn't they also make note of the fact that the synthetics at Santa Anita had been, in the later years, had been far superior safety-wise than dirt, pointing to the example, you know, that they had one part of the issue. Now, Jim Gagliano, the president of the Jockey Club, called me directly after that to discuss it, said I'd been unfair about it. you know, I listened to him, and he's a decent guy. I like him a lot. Of course, he represents a bigger group, and he has to go with whatever that company line is. But, you know, I did mention, I said, Jim, if you're going to bring that up, your organization needs to step up and at least mention the safety of the synthetics. Of course, they can't, because those guys in the breeding business don't want that right now, right? So, you know, there's lots of conflicts that Tim was talking about, and you were, and you know, it's about having to work around it. Ironically, it was really funny, because on Sunday I was at the world premiere of Catherine DeFrancis, Joe DeFrancis's wife. She used to work at the Daily Racing Forum and Racing Times. She's now a filmmaker, made a great film. And there was a world premiere, and at the after party, just ironically, Jim Gagliano was there, and also was Jerry Brown, who just written an anti-LASIX piece.
That great piece, yep.
I mean, a LASIX piece, and, you know, pro-LASIX piece, against the people who are trying to fight it, which is the Jockey Club. So the two of them were standing right next to each other, and it's funny how there was a physical representation of two diverging views, but they were, you know, speaking quite cordially, like each other. I found out they've even gone out together before.
Oh, sure.
And, yeah, and when I spoke to Jerry said, you know what, Jim's real reasonable on this, but, you know, he's got a big caucus behind him. And so, so that's, you know, that just shows you that, even though there are these major issues out there, the people behind the issues are humans that interact, speak, and they can very well cordially come to some type of middle ground if allowed to.
Right. Well, that's listen. That's that's the scenario for countless issues that you know, where the loggerheads are. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's why I brought that one up, because
that's a good one.
I want to go watch some TV right now.
I hear you. All right, I'll let you do it. Actually,
I got it on mute. Yeah,
that's okay. All right. Go ahead. We'll wait till next week to summarize the sale. I don't know if you heard Nicole Russo's. She was terrific yesterday, kind of hitting some of the big stories. Annals of Time will sell today, and there's a number of racing prospects changed hands, a lot of international bloodstock maneuvers, some very interesting themes regarding new sires and in foal mares. And we'll get a complete summary, Sid, when we talk next week.
But Steve, actually, I forgot to tell you this. I'm going to be on vacation for the next
Few
weeks.
All right.
Yeah. So we'll get together when I get back.
No, that's fine. Not a problem. Right. Well, then, happy Thanksgiving. Where are you spending Thanksgiving?
Happy Thanksgiving. I'm going to be out of the country, but I'll be in Europe. It's somewhere on a bike.
Nice, undisclosed location. All right, keep give us a travelogue. If it's Tuesday, it must be Belgium, and we'll see where it takes you. Sid, as always, I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. A little bit, that was pedigree-esque. It wasn't all pedigree, obviously. Our friend Glenn, who sent in a question for Sid. Glenn will ask that question of Sid when he comes back in a few weeks. Let's take a break. When we come back, though, Joe Manning, the Louisville Story Program, better lucky than good, the current title that the program, Oral Histories, but it's way bigger. What they're doing with this Louisville Story Program, it's wonderful. And they're unearthing just a variety of community, you know, interwoven communities throughout Louisville, and they're letting people tell their stories, and it's magical, really special what they're doing. And we'll talk obviously about this book and about the Churchill storytellers, but also, you know, give you a feel for what the concept of the Louisville Story Program is achieving. Joe Manning joins us next at the races.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up with ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use ExpressFund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're gonna love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line 800-522-4700.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Horseville.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horseville.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horseville.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horseville.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Old friends, including the great champions that inspired unforgettable memories, and maybe even let you cash a ticket or two over the years. We even have a former child prodigy.
Here is a superstar. That horse's name is Afternoon Delights, and Kent the Summer on Afternoon Delights, absolutely galloping in the Hollywood Futurities.
These are the champions that help out the horses that might not have won a Grade One race, but always tried just as hard. Come visit them all at Old Friends when you're in Kentucky or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Surprise, surprise, so you rub your eyes. Never knew you'd a yes. Was eyes hit a vice pen, built a stupefy. Ducks categorize us as hard cries. That's a lie, we know why we're occupiers. No words but obscure style, and these are higher. Profiles are low as soon as we go. As a priest straight from a deeper shade of soul.
Deeper shade of soul.
We're back at the races, coming up to the top of hour three on this interesting, eclectic Wednesday. And it's going to continue in that vein because an absolute pleasure to have Joe Manning join us. He's the deputy director of the Louisville Story Program, which I became aware of about 6 weeks ago or so. Jim Mulvihill sent me a note and said, I'm going to send you a book from this project that took place on the backstretch, oral histories. And I got it and saw right away that it was going to be interesting and captivating. Didn't get a chance to really read it until I was flying back from Breeders' Cup when I had the long flight on Tuesday night and read the first five stories and was just blown away and could not wait. I knew we were going to talk to either Darcy Thompson or Joe Manning or both, and Joe's the one that joins us. Joe, a real pleasure, and congratulations to you and Darcy and Liz Sawyer, everybody involved in this really, to me, just fascinating project.
Hey, Steve, thanks so much for having us. This is really a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Not at all. It is involved on the racetrack and telling stories that any sure. any horse player, any stakeholder, anybody that's a fan of the game is going to really enjoy. There's a lot of that, but the best part of this is discovering what you are all doing with the Louisville Story Program, which is unearthing stories and lives and experiences that generally go untold.
That's exactly right. You said it best. That's amazing. I've been trying to come up with a pithy way of describing what we do in Louisville for a long time, and I think you really hit it on the head. I mean, our work at Louisville Story Program is to reach out to folks in our community and just sort of give them the tools and opportunities needed to amplify their voices and stories so that we can sort of know our neighbors with a little more clarity and depth, and especially those folks we don't hear from often enough. But it is not relegated to Louisville, Kentucky. As you said, with regards to this book is relevant sort of all over the world, both to folks who are interested in racetracking, you know, horse players and the like, and also anybody who likes to, you know, feels like they need to experience the world from another person's perspective. These are really in-depth and rigorous and very humane stories told from the inside out. And in the voices of our authors, I didn't write this book. We didn't write this book. We're just sort of the vehicle for delivering the stories of folks who participated in their own words.
That's the case with this and with the other pieces that are part of the collection of the Louisville Story Program, and we'll touch on those as part of the discussion. But I'm interested, first of all, in the origins of how you and Darcy and the board and how all of this came to even be, whether it's a grant or how
sure.
This was even conceived as a project.
This particular project on the backside is our sixth book. So Louisville Story Program, we kind of got the wheels rolling in the winter of 2013 when Darcy Thompson, the director, and I sort of dreamt up a sort of publishing idea focusing at first on youth authors. Half of our books are written by young authors in high schools. We reach out to high schools in Louisville, whose students are from traditionally underrepresented populations, and we conduct really rigorous, 18-month-long college-level creative writing workshops and just sort of give them the tools and opportunities they need to write with extreme depth and clearness and attention, write about their lives and experiences, and also conduct oral histories in their neighborhoods. The other half of our books are conducted in a little bit of a different fashion, like what we did on the backside, which is to do in-depth and recursive oral histories with folks, sit down with folks many, many times and just listen to them talk about their lives and experiences, and then work with them collaboratively to edit the transcripts of those interviews into a narrative, into a first-person narrative. I don't know if you remember Studs Terkel, but he was a sort of folklorist and oral historian and radio man, and he had a couple of books that were written in this way, sitting down with folks and just letting them talk about their lives and then just sort of editing the results of those interviews into clear first-person narratives. And the way that we collaborate with our authors really gives them authorship, and that's why we refer to them as authors. So the folks who wrote this book did so in that manner, which is a really rewarding way to make a book. And so, we think of our job as reaching out to folks we don't hear from often enough, and I, as a Louisvillian, I've lived here my entire life. I grew up here. I've been here 42 years, and I am not unique in the ways in which I have absolutely no idea about racetracking and Churchill Downs and how folks, you know, engage in the industry and spend entire careers. Most Louisvillians, the home of the home of the most iconic racetrack in the world, the Derby City, most Louisvillians just don't really have a great idea of what goes on at the track and on the backside. So we knew that it was the perfect environment for a deep dive documentary effort. So we spent 3 years hanging around on the backstretch. As you probably know, racetrackers are not immediately the most forthcoming crowd in the entire world. Especially to an outsider, so I really did have to sort of embed myself and make friends and hang around for a long time before I turned on a tape recorder, just getting the lay of the land. But by and by, I was able to really make some fantastic contacts and, you know, make friends on the backside. And so we spent 3 years back there recording a lot of interviews and really diving in deep to get these stories.
They really cut just a remarkable swath of experience too. I mean, there's every part of life on the racetrack represented in the 30 plus stories.
Yeah, I tell you what, Steve, it's the you know, to have worked on this book for 3 years with all these folks, to get to the publishing date and to start getting feedback from folks is more rewarding than I could have possibly imagined. And for somebody like you and the racetrackers that I know on the track to have such a positive response to it really blows my mind, and it just means the world to me. So thank you for that. And it's because we worked really hard to do just that, you know, just publish a representative sort of sampling of what the backside of an American thoroughbred racetrack looks like and who lives there and who works there and what their lives are like. Just, you know, a brief glimpse, but we think a pretty thorough sort of a thorough undertaking and a thorough example of who works on the backside. And it's a lot of people, you know, for our racetrack at Churchill Downs, something like 1,000 people come to work back there every day during a meet. And, you know, literally, this is a village in South Louisville that is fenced off from the rest of the community. And most folks just have no idea the nuance and sort of vivid community that exists on the backside of a racetrack. It's fantastic. And there are a lot of dedicated folks, you know, grinding away 7 days a week. Every other day besides Derby Day in South Louisville, there's something going on the backside of Churchill Downs.
The stories, I'm curious if after a certain point, and once you engaged and mm-hmm. once you had, you know, had a few of the visits, you know, in the can, did some of them, you know, kind of come to you? Did people seek you out? You know, talk a little bit about the interpersonal portion of this and how word spread, because there's an emotional wallop involved here, Joe, that had to be taxing to hear some of these stories. And when it comes to in particular, you know, the Latinx component of this and, you know, some of the personal, you know, harrowing journeys. I mean, sure. The lifestyle is demanding. When you're
absolutely
anybody familiar with Greta Kunstweiler's story,
absolutely.
You know, there had to be, you know, some real jarring and emotional toll taken as you acquired these stories.
Yeah, no, that's I couldn't agree with you more about all of that, Steve. But I wouldn't think of it so much as an emotional toll as much as an opportunity. And I'm not just spinning it here. I'm actually the perfect guy for my job, because I really adore and am honored to sit inside of a couple of headphones and listen to people as they talk about their lives and experiences. And I know, because I've been doing this long enough, that when you sit down with somebody and say, hey, I think you've lived a remarkable life, and I'd really like to hear you talk about it. Can we sit down for an hour and a half and sort of get to know each other? It means the world to people to be given that opportunity and to finally say their piece, you know, in their own words. I think Greta's a great example because, you know, her life has been played out and lived out very publicly at times. And there have been some great sort of profiles of Greta written before. But think about it like this. For somebody who's lived a very public life, to sit down on, I don't even know how many hours of interviews Greta and I did, many, and to say her piece in her own words and to organize her life story in her own words, I get the feeling from her that it was, you know, it was restorative and it meant a lot to her to do that. That's my sensation. I mean, you'd have to ask her. But regardless, her story in the book is an amazing story of trial and triumph, and it's a really humane telling of a sometimes joyful and funny and sometimes taxing and burdensome experience that she's had in her life, like all of us. And that's the whole point. That's why I love to do the job that I do, is because I get to hear from people telling different sort of varieties of the same types of stories. That's the whole point, is for people to be able to listen to somebody like my friends Cristobal Resendez Trejo or Christina Bahana, who seemingly we don't have very much in common with and who have lived lives that are really remarkable and sometimes harrowing, as you said, but their impulses, the things that are important to them, are just the same as the rest of us. Take care of our families, be good to our friends, have a fruitful livelihood. You know what I mean? And so there's a real opportunity for a book like this, not just for the readers, but I think actually in race tracking. I mean, as somebody who hasn't spent a life on the backside, I recognize some divisions and some gaps of understanding that exist in racing that I think everyone would be well served to sort of shore up. So to have the experiences of different sort of sections and communities of thoroughbred racing right next to each other, one after another, in a book, I think is a great opportunity for everybody just to sort of, like I always say, get to know their neighbors with a little more clarity. Everybody wins when we hear from one another. You know what I mean?
Oh, no, absolutely, and perfectly put. I would go even, you know, steps further by incorporating the potential for this book and the stories within to generate empathy in some areas that our society at large is really lacking, and it won't take anybody long to read on that front.
No, it's really true. I'm really glad to hear you say it too, because you know I always like to think that if you get stuck in an elevator with anybody, I mean really almost anybody, if you spend enough time with somebody, you will invariably have an empathetic connection with them and understand the ways that we are not only similar to, but reliant upon one another. Geez, I mean, really, when you think about it, the backside of a racetrack is a perfect example. There's 1,000 people on the backside of Churchill Downs because there needs to be 1,000 people on the backside of Churchill Downs to put on a horse race. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So we all really do rely upon one another. And gosh, what an awesome place to hang out too. As somebody who didn't grow up on a racetrack, I mean, it was thrilling and really cool to be able to get a real glimpse at what goes on back there. It's a blast.
There's other portions of the stories as you, and I'm only 25% into it, so I've got another 20 sections to read, but
yeah,
one of the things that I already did. I mean, I loved it. I loved it a third of the way into Bob DeCenzi's, you know, opening chapter. That is,
yeah,
that will absolutely just will rock anybody.
Mm-hmm.
immediately, and you know, particularly given the backdrop of what we're going through as an industry.
Right, of course.
Bob's specific story regarding the best horse that ever came his way, and losing that horse the way that he did.
That's right.
That'll strike at the heart of everybody that wants to understand the sport and the people that are involved. But one of the things that I am really struck with is the generational elements here and the way in which, particularly from the grooms, the timeline of the kind of people that have come to the racetrack to groom horses. And the book actually has got that passing of the torch, essentially, from the African-American groom through the greater part of the century to the Latino community that has taken up, this really has taken up the mantle. And it's very evident here. And both the joy that the stories, the groom stories in particular, tell, no matter how hard the work will have everybody smiling.
Absolutely, yeah, I agree with you, and you know, one of the real fantastic parts of this book for me was learning more about my city, the neighborhood, the city I grew up in, and the neighborhood where I now live. Between this book and another one conducted in the same part of Louisville, I just fell in love with South Louisville, and we bought a house down here and are raising a family here now. And also to learn more about the generational impact of the neighborhood on the backside and the presence of African Americans from South Louisville, just filtering generation after another onto the backside, and what that's meant for a lot of people. We are one of the authors, Sylvia Arnett, just grew up literally in the shadows of the Twin Spires from the time she was a kid. She tells stories about hanging around at this place they called the Chippy Joint, which was like a little juke joint in her neighborhood. When she was a little kid, all the kids would play outside. But she talks about when the seasons, when the meets would come in and all the horses would start to show up, so would all of their friends who had been gone on the circuit for a year or so. And everybody would be hollering out through the neighborhood, so-and-so's showed up, so-and-so's here. And she'd go down and see Jimmy Wakefield hanging around at the Chippy Joint. Sylvia's an elderly woman now, and was a kid when Wakefield would come around. And to have that direct connection to such significant history and racing, right here in the neighborhood, was a fantastic way to be introduced to the history of South Louisville. And Miss Sylvia runs a bar down on Broadway in West Louisville, and she's going to host, we just launched the book last week, and here on the 21st, she's going to host an evening of sort of storytelling, a sort of bull sesh for African-Americans who grew up on the racetrack. So we're going to have sort of a party at Sills Lounge, and African-American racetrackers are going to show up and just sort of swap stories. It's going to be a fantastic night.
There's so many names and faces that people are going to recognize, even if you're just somebody that shows up at the Downs Derby Week. Money Getz and of course Butch Lear retired now, but there's one after another that you see, and some are very much behind the scenes, like Sherry Stanley at the backside at the wonderful Learning Center.
Absolutely.
I cannot gush enough about Joe, about what has been achieved here.
Thank you so much, Steve. Yeah, and like you said, the interconnectivity, I think, how could you know? Everybody is relying upon one another back there. And so, for instance, I came to the backside because Sherry Stanley had put on Craigslist that she was selling some bookshelves. I'd moved back to town and needed some sturdy bookshelves. So I went to the Backside Learning Center to buy these bookshelves, met Sherry, and I said, what do you guys do back here? And she told me about it, and I started teaching English as a second language at Backside Learning Center. That was my introduction to the Backside. And in that time, I got to understand what an incredible community it was. And so I said to Darcy, man, this is the spot. This is the story that nobody has really published yet about the history of the Backside and the community that works every day here in the Derby City to put on the races at the world's most famous racetrack. And so to sort of document and live that interconnectivity was really fascinating and gratifying. And somebody like my friend Marilyn Cano Hernandez, who graduated high school last year, walks HOTS in the morning in the same barn as her dad. All of her brothers are exercise riders. She got a job also at Backside Learning Center, and we sort of deputized Marilyn to conduct a few interviews in the book. So she interviews Sherry Stanley. She interviews Daisy from the chaplaincy. And so in that way, we were able to sort of even get deeper into the interconnectivity of the Backside. And, she had access to parts of the Backside that we didn't. And it was just—it's just an amazing thing to have documented and to have lived through, and now to share with everybody else. I'm so thrilled that it comes across to readers like you that it really does ring out how interconnected the Backside is.
Yeah, the other thing that it does, and I'm sure that I'll discover it, even more common names and themes, it brings back to life any number of venues and moments and individuals. I mean, just in the first handful of chapters, Jerry Romans.
Yeah, yeah, for
Dale's
sure.
father, who was taken at a young age, and Blackie Huffman, Huffman's run throughout this. Miles Park lives again through these stories.
Absolutely, yeah. It was really a treat for us to learn more about that. I'll tell you one thing. I if I had it all to do over again, and we tried, but we were unable to document the history of Douglas Park as much as I wanted to. Douglas Park was another racetrack just a stone's throw away from Churchill Downs.
Yes.
Right in the neighborhood. And a lot of racetrackers grew up there and sort of cut their teeth there. But they're just the photographic evidence is next to nothing as far as I can tell. And there are still some stories out there. And I know a few folks who raced there. So I'm hoping this winter, when folks are on the road, to conduct a few more interviews and get some in the can about Douglas Park. Fascinating history there.
There was something either this past Derby or maybe the previous fall for Breeders' Cup. There's either Google Map aerials or aerial photographs that show the circumference of the oval of Douglas.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can. It's still there. It's still a big old. It makes for a really weird traffic pattern in that part of the neighborhood. Streets come together in all kinds of weird angles. And interestingly, there's a what's called the Americana Community Center there now, which is a meeting place for a lot of the immigrant and refugee communities that live in South Louisville. So it kind of comes full circle. It's a pretty neat sort of object, a demonstration of the way the neighborhood has changed and the way the racetrack has changed. But it's still there. So the pillars there's still pillars that say Douglas Park right there at Americana. It's a cool history and not very well documented, but we hope to kind of get there in subsequent interviews.
There's so much of Louisville that has got incredibly vivid storylines, and
sure,
this was obviously a natural. I don't want to just wrap up and tell everybody to buy the book without touching on the other, you know, the other books that people should really, and I'll certainly be ordering them myself, but I'd love you to tell everybody about the other things that are available, including the photography, which obviously is a big part of better lucky than good. We should add. Mm-hmm. I mean, the photographies and the photographers that are included in the book.
Man, boy, we just, you know, sometimes it just feels like providence. One of the authors, Carla Grego, who works at the Derby Museum as the horseman's relations liaison. We met Carla by happenstance, and she introduced us to an old groom who worked for Neil J. Howard for a long time, who was an amateur shutterbug, there's a whole central fold in the book, which you've probably seen, of candid shots on the backside from the 60s and 70s and 80s. And it just absolutely makes up the visual tone of the whole book. It sets the standard. And that was just a casual chance introduction. And I don't know what we would have done without the photos of Clark Oddie, who's become a good friend and is just a race, you know, just a horseman extraordinaire. And some great pictures from Pat McDonough of the Courier Journal as well. And just a slew of great photos from the contributors. Yeah, the visual element came together right at the end, nearly gave me a heart attack. I was scrambling trying to get photos up to the bitter end, but it came out really well, I think, and especially with the hands of our designer, Shelley Marie Jones, who's just a phenom. So it's a good-looking book, and we're really proud of it. It was a labor of love. You know, like I said at the book launch the other day, we know it's a good Louisville Story Program because it took absolutely forever, immense resources, and a ton of people to put together. That's how we know that we did it right. So we're really glad to offer it to the public. And the other books folks can find on LouisvilleStoryProgram.org are some of our high school books, No Single Sparrow Makes a Summer, which was written by 9 young women from Iroquois High School just up the road from Churchill Downs. It's an absolutely phenomenal book written by 6 immigrant young women and 3 American young women. It'll blow your mind, passion and real clarity with which these young women have documented their lives. It's incredible. And the photo book you mentioned is Available Light, which is a sort of hardcover book honoring the legacy of Bud Dorsey, who's a fantastic street photographer from West Louisville. And, you know, a book from the Kentucky School for the Blind, another book from Shawnee High School, the Academy at Shawnee, was our first book, was a breakout hit, and a really cool documentary book called I Said Bang, which is a history of the Dirt Bowl. The Dirt Bowl is a pickup basketball tournament that's been going on in West Louisville since the mid-60s. It's just a fantastic document of a really important community-building effort that's been going on in West Louisville for a long time. So that's our library, and those are available, like I said, at LouisvilleStoryProgram.org, but also at Amazon.com, where your listeners can find Better Lucky Than Good.
I'll send out links to everything. What's on the agenda? What are you looking at, and what is down the road for the program?
Sure, yeah. We always have a few balls in the air, so even when we've been wrapping up work on Better Lucky Than Good, we've been starting work on the next youth project, a year-long, two-semester-long, in-depth college-level creative writing workshop at Central High School, which is a really important high school in the history of African-American Louisville. It's going to be a fantastic project. There are a few radio elements, too. We're now teaching a podcasting unit, so this will be our sort of second iteration of the audio storytelling unit. The last one was broadcast on our local NPR affiliate and was just a jaw-dropper. I mean, really fantastic stories from you know, folks in Louisville who might have never otherwise been on the radio. The listeners may have never heard stories from some of these folks, and they are arresting and humane and really important stories. Just like, if I don't say so myself, all of our books, I think, are truly important. And we're just so honored to be the sort of stewards of so many great stories in Louisville.
Well, and since you brought it up, I will put in my own plug. There is no place I go where I'm not listening to our own network, to SiriusXM, except when I drive in and spend the 2 weeks in the Ville for Derby, because WFPL is as good a radio station, and I don't have to qualify it by calling it public radio, it's as good a radio station mm-hmm. as there is anywhere mm-hmm. in the country. The music and the talk shows and everything, the music is beyond belief. And FPL is an exceptional, it's amazing to me, actually. And I look forward to getting into town to have FPL on all 2 weeks.
Yeah, they're fantastic.
Yeah, they do a great job.
Well, give me a buzz next time you're in town, Steve. Let's
absolutely.
Get a copy or something. It's been a blast to talk to you. Thank you so much.
I can't thank you enough for the time and for this effort and for making permanent the voices of the backstretch and of the community in and around the Downs. Better lucky than good. $25 is a bargain for this. And that's a little silly, but all right. It's crazy that it's $25 and it's beautiful, the pictures and the stories. Who finances the story program?
Well, we sell a lot of books. And we also write a lot of grants, and we do development here. The Louisville Story Program is a 501c3 nonprofit, very small group. There's three of us. Just 6 months ago, we hired our third full time staff. And outside of that, Darcy and I have been working on these books, since 2013.
Just amazing.
With a lot of community support. And with regards to our youth projects, our authors are paid in advance on their royalties for their work. Since 2013, our authors have earned $35,000 about in royalties for their work.
Well, and there's a section at the website, LouisvilleStoryProgram.org, where those that are going to be instantly fascinated by this, you can volunteer your time and skills as well yourself and volunteer. And Joe and Darcy will put you right to work.
All right. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Joe Manning, everybody. The Louisville Story Program, better lucky than good. Tall tales and straight talk from the backside of the racetrack. I cannot tell you. I'm a quarter of the way through, and it one after the other. It's moving. It's uplifting. It's informative. It just, you frankly will not believe, how engaged you'll be by these stories. Let's take a break. Bottom of the hour, Seth Merrow. Speaking of engaging and enlightening and moving, Seth joins us next.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
DRF Sports Forum Digital Edition, your ultimate weekly betting guide. Published by Daily Racing Form, DRF Sports Forum delivers all of the analysis and insight you need for every NFL game and more than 40 college football matchups. Beat the spread with powerful trends and sharp angles. Tap into best bets, expert picks, parlay winners, and more. All for just $4.99 per issue. Get this week's edition free. Visit drf.com/sportsforum. Enter code DRF Sports.
Are you on? University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Do you ever wonder what happens to your old friends, including the great champions that inspired unforgettable memories, and maybe even let you cash a ticket or two over the years? We even have a former child prodigy.
Here is a superstar. That horse's name is Afternoon Delights, and kept the Sarmon Afternoon Delights absolutely galloping in the Hollywood Futurities.
These are the champions that help out the horses that might not have won a Grade 1 race, but always tried just as hard. Come visit them all at Old Friends when you're in Kentucky or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
Get started in Kentucky. Over $8 million in additional purse money is available at the five Kentucky tracks for horses eligible for the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund. Kentucky is a good place to race your Kentucky bred. Come home to Kentucky and make a start.
HorseBills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through HorseBills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the HorseBills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. HorseBills.com. Toll-free number 888-9
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
You want to take control of me? You're messing with the enemy. Said it's true. It's another trick. Messing with my mind. I wake up, chase down an empty street. Blind and snap the broken beast. Said it's gone with the dirty trick.
We're back at the races. Real pleasure to have Joe Manning join us. The Louisville Story program, better lucky than good. When we get off the air, I'll send you the link. But if you want to go straight to their website, LouisvilleStoryProgram.org. I know